But the cumulative result is to create a society in which you cannot meaningfully participate in the society at all unless you are carrying one of these with you, seemingly at all times.
Welcome to Christ and Culture, the podcast of the L. Russ Bush Center for Faith and Culture at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. Here we'll explore how the Christian faith intersects all avenues of today's culture through conversations with leading thinkers. Welcome to the conversation.
Hey everyone, I'm Ken Keithley.
And I'm Benjamin Quinn.
And welcome to another episode of Christ and Culture. Today, Dr. Quinn is going to talk to Brad Littlejohn about the soft tyranny of smartphones. You'll enjoy that. And after that, we'll have another edition of On My Bookshelf.
But first, it's time for our segment called Headlines, in which we look at some aspect of the headlines, such as news, sports, pop culture, or business, from a Christian perspective.
Now, normally, during this segment, we would talk about the important events going on in the world, but today, let's talk about some important news for our podcast. Nathaniel, what's in the news?
Well, in the news for the Christ and Culture podcast is that next week's episode is episode number 150. Can you guys believe that? 150 episodes of Christ and Culture.
Yeah, time flies when you're having fun.
Time flies when you're having fun. And we want our listeners to have some fun. So to celebrate episode number 150, we are doing one of our biggest giveaways of all time. We have 9 books. We have a Center for Faith and Culture travel mug, a Center for Faith and Culture baseball cap, which is really nice.
And this next one is Dr. Quinn's favorite.
CFC throw blanket, which is an inside joke for our office, but we have some Center for Faith and Culture blankets. And let me just say, listeners, I was one of the ones that thought this was a silly idea. Why would we need CFC branded blankets? But we have one at my house and my toddler loves it. It's the only blanket he wants to use in the den is the CFC blanket. So maybe, listeners, your toddler will want this blanket too. To enter, here's what you need to do. There's a link in our show notes. Click that link. Please share your feedback for the podcast. We got just a couple of questions to ask to get your feedback. This will help us in preparing for the next season of the podcast as well. You're automatically going to be entered to win the contest then. And on next week's show, we will select one lucky winner. And we're going to read some of your comments on episode 150. So go in there, even if you don't want to win the blanket, which who wouldn't want
you
the
do.
Blanket?
You want to win the
you
blanket.
You want the blanket. Go ahead and click the link in our show notes. Share your feedback. You're going to be entered. We're going to pick one of you on next week's episode. And then for many of the rest of you, we will read your comments and your feedback on episode 150.
I do feel, Nathaniel, that we should almost offer an apology for sending a throw blanket. But, you know, we are giving you a baseball cap. So if you're offended by a throw blanket or you just don't feel like it matches your level of masculinity, we are giving you a trucker style baseball hat. Enjoy.
It's going to be a good contest. So you guys make sure to enter it. And I think we have drug this into the ground. Let's head to our Christ and Culture conversation.
Smartphones have become an indispensable part of our lives, or at least smartphone developers would like for us to think so. But have we allowed these devices too much control in our lives? And what might we do about it? Joining us today to help answer this question is Dr. Brad Littlejohn. Brad Littlejohn is a fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center and former president as well as founder of the Davenant Institute. He's co-author of a new article in the National Affairs called The Soft Tyranny of Smartphones, as well as has authored a number of other volumes that we might give a little bit of attention to at the end of our time. But first, Dr. Littlejohn, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
So in this article, which I'm really grateful that you sent to me, this is what put it on my radar, Brad, was you sent this to me, I'm sure along with a host of other people, but I was fascinated with this, especially as a guy who I have 4 kids. All 4 of them love to grab my phone and threaten to take it. And my response is always something like, "Don't threaten me with a good time. I would be glad for you to take my phone. I don't particularly love the smartphone for multiple reasons." And yet, it does seem like it becomes increasingly a requirement. So you mentioned in this article. Let me read this line. I want you to respond to it, and then if you will, just kind of give us the overarching sort of thesis in your article. You write this: the smartphone has transformed from a consumer choice into a social passport. I love that language. From a consumer choice to a social passport, an indispensable tool for participation in today's economy. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So this idea of social passport, I mean, it's what it sounds like. It's a passport for access into society, for participation within educational institutions, in government institutions, in everyday transactions. And in as much as we think about this notion at all, we kind of associate it with a totalitarian society like China. I mean, China, particularly during the pandemic, but I think to some extent, even outside the pandemic, has a system where, you know, you have your government issued ID is plugged into all these electronic surveillance systems to sort of keep track of you wherever you're going. And if you're blacklisted for any reason, then you might not even be able to leave your house, right? You don't have access to society. And we saw a little bit of this during the pandemic, and the conservatives recognized the danger when it came to vaccines. So, you know, Ron DeSantis quite famously, you know, passed executive orders saying in Florida, and a number of governors did this, that businesses could not make their services contingent upon having a vaccine card. Now, it's interesting, some on the right sort of pushed back and said, well, isn't this, you know, isn't this a question for the free market? If individual businesses want to do that, that's up to them. They might get less customers, you know. And if it had been just a matter of certain businesses require this, so other businesses didn't, then I think it wouldn't have been such a big deal. You could just say, hey, look, I prefer to shop at a store where I know everybody's vaccinated versus I prefer to shop at a store which doesn't require that, right? You could let the market decide. The problem was that in that situation, you had a lot of peer pressure among businesses, but also certain, I think there was a sense of economic incentives. Many businesses felt like the best way to minimize their own liability for their employees or whatever was to require vaccination, right? And then there was this peer pressure that was being put on businesses so that the concern was you could have entire sectors that were instituting these requirements. So it's like, I can't say, I'm not going to go to this pizza place, I'm going to go to that pizza place. You can't go to any pizza place. They're all requiring it, right?
Right.
And that is this kind of situation that we're in with smartphone, that we're getting to the point where there are industry-wide expectations that you need this device with you in order possibly, maybe not quite yet to order a pizza, but you know the kind of, it seems to me the QR code menu is maybe receded.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of, yeah.
Well, people do like their paper menus, it seems. And so a lot of restaurants have reintroduced those. But it's still, there's at least a kind of two-tier system, right? If you have the app, you go to the front of the line, your order gets priority, you have access to special coupons and discounts. Yes, okay, we'll still let you order without the app. But there's other areas in which you don't have that option at all. I've been to parking garages where you have to have a smartphone to park. There are apartment buildings that now, and Airbnbs that use smartphone app to unlock. There are many workplaces. You have to get a Google Authenticator app or something like that, Microsoft Authenticator, in order just to log into your work email or your school email. Yeah. I mean, all of us can think of example after example of this sort of thing. And what it amounts to, right, in the aggregate, it's a lot of individual businesses kind of following the path of least resistance, but the cumulative result is to create a society in which you cannot meaningfully participate in the society at all unless you are carrying one of these with you, seemingly at all times.
So let me play a little bit of devil's advocate here. And I appreciate what you've written, but let me just take the other side and say, Brad, look, it's 2024. Man, we're the most technologically advanced. This is where everything's going. Don't be a curmudgeon. What's the problem? So how would you address, just to clarify the concern,
right.
What's
Absolutely.
Really the problem here?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, there's some areas in which you just say, look, technology advances. And if you want to live in society, you got to work with the technology that society has, right? I mean, there was a period after electricity was invented in which it was an option. But after a while, it was basically, no, you need electricity, that there were things that we designed, you know, they were designed to run on gas. But then there was also a version that ran on electricity. But then over time, there's only a version that runs on electricity.
Right.
So you need
right.
electricity. Or you have to have, you know, telephone access or whatever, right? So there are things like that. And I think some would say, well, that's just where we're at now with the smartphone. That said, with any technology, we do have to ask, what are the benefits and what are the harms? And is there a way in which we can harness the benefit, we can gain the benefits while limiting the harms? And it's unquestionable that whatever the benefits of smartphones, they also come with tremendous harms. This is especially the case with kids who haven't yet developed impulse control and are being given this thing, this device that is just sort of designed to harness that lack of impulse control and to turn it into the worst forms of addiction, to give them access to all kinds of, sexually explicit content. And exposure to sexual predators. There's a lot of documentation now of how you have people who are sexual predators who are on not just like the obvious places, you know, like Instagram or whatever. That's a concern enough given how many young people are on Instagram. But even, you know, hanging out in places that parents would never think, you know, there's like a chat, you know, there's a video game that has a chat function. And sure enough, there's actually a way to send sexually explicit images through that chat function.
Yeah.
So this is very dangerous for children. But of course, it's also not great for us as adults. A lot of us would like at least to be able to choose and say, you know what, I'd rather not use this device. Or to say, I have to have this device, but I'd like to not have to bring it with me everywhere, right?
Right, right.
And so I think the question is, okay, given that there's these harms, is there anything we can do about it? And here, looking at the history of technology, we have great examples to draw on, all right? So, electricity comes with pros and I suppose cons, but the cons of electricity are very, very few compared to the pros. I mean, yes, you can have like a, you know, bad wiring can cause a house fire, but you know what? You had a lot more house fires back when you had gas heating, right? So there's not that much of a downside. With automobiles is an example where we had this technology that very valuable, and yet we realized also both dangerous and it had dangers and also inconveniences, right? Dangers were, look, you can kill people with one of these things, right? Especially if you're not, you know, experienced and know how to handle yourself behind the wheel. So for that reason, we put rules requiring how automobiles had to be built to make them safer, seatbelt laws, and of course, licensing laws. You had to show a certain level of, you had to reach a certain age and show a certain level of skill before you could use the thing. Now, I would submit that smartphones, based on the data we're seeing now, are just as dangerous as automobiles. Of course, actually, the two together are particularly dangerous, right? All of the texting and driving accidents that we see. So therefore, doesn't it just stand to reason that we would say, great technology, but let's have an age minimum. Let's maybe require smartphone manufacturers to put certain, like build certain safety features into it. That just makes sense. The other thing is with automobiles, we could say, okay, it's not just that they're dangerous. It's also they're noisy. The building, building our cities around just people driving everywhere kind of destroys the atmosphere that we would want in terms of like walkable neighborhoods. And so we've said, you know what? A lot of cities have said, we're going to make a pedestrian only area. Like these blocks, you can't have cars here, right? Or although there's an area in which you can have cars, but we also want to make it possible for someone not to have a car if they, for any reason, they don't want to. So we're going to have bike lanes. What I'm suggesting is you do the same thing with smartphones. You say, society has a vested interest in saying, here's some smartphone-free spaces, like schools, for instance. Wouldn't that be great, right? Here's smartphone-free spaces. And here's other spaces in which you can use a smartphone, but we also have a bicycle lane, as it were, right? We have the non-smartphone route. So all of that is, I think you can say technology is good, technology is here to stay, but technology also has dangers and therefore needs to be a servant, not a master.
That's really helpful, Brian. And you're right. You're right to lean back into some of these examples that maybe are so far removed from us, even though they're not that far back, even things like the advent of electricity or the automobile or whatever. We've all grown up with these things, so we haven't really thought about, certainly didn't experience the option to be without electricity or really even without the automobile. But the smartphone is a little bit different. You and I are just old enough to recall when Steve Jobs walked out and introduced the smartphone and his awesome outfit that he always wore, or at least the iPhone. And yet it seems to me it seems to me slightly different, even though, than electricity or the automobile, because electricity does one thing. I mean, it powers a million things, but it does one thing. The automobile is designed for really for kind of one thing as well, by way of transportation and a medium of transportation. The smartphone, though, is interesting because it is a form of technology that is all about consolidating everything into that single hold in your hand pad or tablet type of experience. Which means we've had so much conversation in the past about the kind of sexual struggles that can come as a result of that kind of access, things that you mentioned already, or the type of addictions and algorithms and all the rest. What you seem to point out, though, in this article, that's something that probably eludes most people, is not just the dangers of sort of sexual temptations that may come, the dangers of addiction, the dangers of perhaps even being trolled, the dangers of stealing one's identity or having one's identity stolen. But this is one where actually it will be hard, increasingly hard, to be human at home without a smartphone. And you're saying, and you tell me if I'm misunderstanding, but you're saying at least part of what we can do, we don't need to necessarily cut off all technology, but part of what we can do is to always offer some measure of thoughtful resistance to the acquisition of such things, the taking on of such things. There ought to be spaces where there is the smart-free zone, whether that's at home, at school, at church, and maybe that's up to the wisdom of the community. But rather than just always assuming that the next best thing is actually a good thing, a thoughtful resistance and recognizing just how obligatory these things become with respect to our own citizenship. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that we could do is help recover the idea that friction is not a bad thing. So what I mean by that, so many of our technologies now are based on the idea of let's try to reduce friction as much as possible. That is to make all of our everything that we do sort of seamless, as little energy as possible. You just need to think about it and boom, you can do it. All of our interactions can be as quick and seamless as possible. And the smartphone does that. And of course, the next frontier, I wrote a piece about this, is Neuralink, right? Elon Musk wants it where you can implant a chip in your brain and literally you don't even have to have thumbs anymore. All you have to do is think and boom, you tweeted, right? And it's like, is that a good world?
Goodness.
No, it's like Twitter is bad enough when all you have to do is pull a phone out. You think about a kind of snarky, sarcastic comeback, whip your phone out of your pocket, boom, 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 it's out there. How much worse if you could just think about it and do it, right? So friction, I use the metaphor of, again, going back to an automobile. So you can't steer a car without friction, right? If there weren't friction, then the steering apparatus wouldn't work, right? So the only way, and you wouldn't be able to put brakes on the car either, right? So to go anywhere, you actually have, too much friction, you can't go anywhere. Too little friction, you can't control where you go. And so similarly, I would say in our speaking and thinking, we actually need a certain amount of friction, something that sort of slows us down and puts barriers between thought and action if we're actually going to make good judgments and act wisely and choose our words and not get ourselves into trouble. And again, all of the whole development of the smartphone has been, how can we try to create a frictionless world where I can just sort of immediately do whatever it is that comes into my mind to do? And the reality is that doesn't make us more functional. It makes us less functional. We have to, we can tweet quickly and then we spend the rest of the day cleaning up the mess that we made from an ill-considered tweet, right?
So
it's not actually a time-saving device.
That's so true. I love this. The analog between the physics of friction, I mean, really thinking about physics class and learning what we learned about friction is just a part of nature and cause and effect and all these kinds of things, and how that actually maps onto our morals. It's actually, there's something about the way in which we live where when there's resistance with respect to the decisions and actions that we take, that kind of resistance or friction, as you're talking about, is really good for us. The buy now button, or the ease with which we can buy now, think now, tweet now, act now, may not actually be valuable for us, or as valuable as the producers want us to think that they are.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's one thing in which, as parents, as church leaders, school teachers, et cetera, that's where I think we can try to push back and create a culture of not against instant gratification and a culture of making access to technology a little more difficult, not being Luddites, but just making it a little more difficult so that we can really think, okay, I want to do this thing. This device will help me do this thing. Okay, I will go and use this device to help me do this thing. But there's at least enough of a barrier there for that to be a thoughtful process. So I think there's a lot we can do just in our own settings. I think there's also a place, and we talked about this in the article, for public policy solutions. Again, we did this with the automobile. It's not a totalitarian, you know, we didn't have to create a totalitarian society or socialism or whatever in order to make automobiles more safe. And I don't think we have to make smartphones more safe either.
Brad, this is super helpful. Even another way of thinking about this is perhaps inconvenience, whereas everything is about convenience, the less friction, the better, as we've talked about, but perhaps inconvenience might save us a little bit in the long run. If we're willing to be patient and put up with it some, it might actually help us to offer a healthy resistance to think before we act and to resist certain things like technology, certain forms of developing technologies before we just accept them. And the next thing we know, we're trapped by them. This is really helpful. Thanks for your work on this. Brad, where can our listeners read more of your work and find more of your books?
Yeah, so I tweet, at least for now, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, based on what I've just been saying. But I'm in a tweeting season right now at WB Little John on Twitter. I have my longer form writing. Well, I write regular columns for World Magazine in their opinion section, World Opinions. You can find those and any longer form writing is generally all indexed on my EPPC scholars page, eppc.org, and just find my name there and you can find whatever I'm working on.
Fantastic. Brad, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Southeastern understands that you have a strategic and valuable role to play in getting the gospel to your neighbors and the nations. That's why we offer over 40 degrees at the undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral levels to equip you to serve the church and fulfill the Great Commission. Visit sebts.edu to learn more.
Now it's time for our listener favorite segment, On My Bookshelf, the part of the show where our guests share what they're reading right now, or perhaps something that they've read in the past that's among their favorites. We've just been talking with Dr. Brad Littlejohn about technology. He hung around for a little bit longer to talk to us about what's on his bookshelf. Brad, what's on your bookshelf right now?
Well, I've just finished up Oliver O'Donovan's newest book, The Disappearance of Ethics. I'm actually writing a review of it for the Cranmer Theological Journal. And of course, you know, anyone who knows me, it'd be no surprise that I'm reading O'Donovan. I was a graduate student of his and have been deeply formed by his work and try to pick up anything he writes. His writing is not easygoing for the uninitiated. He writes, every word is very carefully chosen and you can't speed through it. You have to really slow down and chew on what exactly he's saying, but it's immensely rewarding. And it's not, you know, people sometimes use the word dense to describe writing that is just, frankly, it's just bad writing. Dense writing is not sort of a euphemism for bad writing. O'Donovan's writing is actually beautiful prose. It's just literally dense. It's just there's a lot packed into it. So, you know, not for the faint of heart, but very valuable. I highly recommend this book. It's a fairly short book, although it covers a lot of ground. It's based on his Gifford Lectures, which is, for those who don't know, a very prestigious lecture series that happens in St. Andrews or one of the other Scottish universities. He did that a couple of years ago. And in many ways, he used it as an opportunity to kind of, you know, he's at the very end of his career as a kind of capstone to his career and reflecting back on the vocation of Christian ethics. So he titles the book, The Disappearance of Ethics. And the claim that he's making is that ethics, as he's not saying we no longer have ethics in our society in the sense that we no longer act ethically. I mean, obviously, that is a concern. But more fundamentally, ethics as a discipline, in order for us to be able to think clearly and talk clearly about what it means to be ethical or moral, is really in crisis. And he talks about three three ways it's in crisis. This is building on his earlier work, Self, World, and Time, where he's like, the moral life is the calling. It has these three dimensions, right? The self, the person as an agent. What does it mean to be a human being? It means to be a moral agent, capable of, when we often just summarize this under the term free will, but that often sort of immediately derails us into theological controversies about predestination, free will. But really, what it means to be a conscious, willing agent with responsibility for our own actions. There's that dimension, self. There's the dimension of the world, the kind of objective, three-dimensional, but not just physical, metaphysical space that we inhabit with its own, with an order, a telos, with certain goods inherent in it. And then time, the idea that our living in time is meaningful, that we actually, we're not just in this sort of cycle of eternal recurrence, but we actually are moving from a past to a future that will in some way give meaning to our past actions. And O'Donovan says that each of these three is under threat. So he has three chapters: the disappearance of the agent, the disappearance of the world, the reality around us, and the disappearance of history. And just summarizing those really quick, you've got basically, I mean, you can see these in a lot of different ways, but one is on the agent, just this idea that all of us are victims now. All of us are passive, right? Agent has to do with being active. None of us are active anymore. We're all passive. We're all victims. We're all looking around talking about the structures of society that made us who we are. And you see this, of course, in discourse on the left, but the right falls into this too. Like, we all have a victim mentality, and we just talk about how we're victimized by the left, and don't talk about what it means to be an agent. So all of our discourse, and we, this is, you know, this idea that we're just kind of determined by our biology or by our surroundings, and no, those things affect us, but we are still an agent called to exercise responsibility in the world. Also, the disappearance of the idea of an objective world that has moral meaning around us. I mean, that's easy to see. We've kind of, the idea that nature or creation is morally weighted is gone, and we see the world as just something that we construct out of our own will. And then history. I think in some ways, what we see today is a growth out of the Christian vision of history. The whole idea of progressivism is the idea that there is progress, that there's movement toward some better future, which was not actually very much a pre-Christian idea. Generally, pre-Christian societies didn't think we were moving toward a better future. They thought we were kind of trapped in an eternal cycle. But the problem is the absolutizing of that is one in which the problem is that future is forever receding, right? There is no, taken out of the realm of Christian theology, progress is never progressing toward some fixed point that is the revelation of God, right? Progress is just becomes progress for progress's sake, right? It's a constantly sort of canceling out whatever we were before in order that we can become something new, which means we really lose our grip on history. So anyway, so he goes through these three, and then he talks about how actually Christianity alone really provides the resources for sustaining an account of the self as an agent, for sustaining an account of the world as a moral order, for sustaining an account of history as coming from somewhere and going somewhere. So ultimately, he uses the modern crisis of ethics as an opportunity to preach the gospel, to say that the reason we're having that crisis is because we've lost the gospel, and only by recovering the gospel can we recover a proper experience for ourselves as moral agents.
Brad, I'm so glad that you're talking about O'Donovan. You of course not only love O'Donovan, but you know my love for him as well. His Resurrection Moral Order, which is several decades old now, when I was required to read that in graduate school, just rocked my world a million ways, and have continued to be so influenced by him. We're going to have to set up another time to just talk about O'Donovan and really just hit highlights on his thought. You and I both have many friends who spend a lot of time reflecting on O'Donovan's work and even seeking to kind of renew that in certain ways for today's conversation. So thank you for reminding our listeners of that. Remind us again the name of this book and where they can find it.
So, The Disappearance of Ethics.
Fantastic. Brad, thank you again for joining us. Look forward to having you on again soon.
Yep, thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed our program, give us a 5-star rating and a brief review on your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next week.